and the power resumes. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Bob Blakely in Geological Sciences. For a Moment of Science, I'm Don Glass.
On Monday, January 12th at 6:25 p.m., WILL-TV and other local stations will conduct an analog shutoff test. At that time, check the TVs in your home. If a set is DTV ready, there will be no program interruption. If it's not ready, you'll see a message with more information on how to prepare for the switch. That's Monday, January 12th at 6:25 p.m.
It's 2:41 p.m. Central Time, 26 degrees in Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. In sports this afternoon, Boston College has fired Jeff Jagodzinski because he interviewed for the New York Jets coaching job. A person with knowledge of the decision tells the Associated Press that the coach was fired today. The person spoke on condition of anonymity because the dismissal had not been announced. In Big East action tonight, DePaul heads to New York to play 11th-ranked Syracuse. The Blue Demons are 8-7 overall this season and winless in conference play, while the Orange is 14-1 and 2-0 in the Big East. Northwestern is on the road to face off against Wisconsin in Big Ten basketball tonight. The Wildcats haven't had a lot of success against the Badgers in the past. Wisconsin leads the all-time series 106 wins. 260. The Salukis are in Kansas tonight to play Wichita State. Southern Illinois brings a 5-9 record into the game, and both SIU and Wichita State are still looking for their first Missouri Valley Conference win of the season. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Busey Bank main branch renovation, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
Talk of changing the nation's health care system is giving some people in Washington a sense of déjà vu. Back in 1993, a new president came to town and his own party held the House and Senate. Tens of millions of people had no health insurance and high hopes for change. That reform effort crashed. Today, the experts involved in the effort say the Obama team will have to do things differently if they want to be successful this time. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
In 1993, Sheila Burke was the top aide to the minority leader of the Senate, Republican Bob Dole. She says bad timing was one of the prime reasons for the failure of the Clinton health plan.
The Clintons had made this issue a critical one in the course of the campaign, talking about health reform, but then essentially let a year go by while their task force pulled things together. And in the course of that, you lost the attention of the American public in many respects, and you also allowed the opponents to essentially mount a campaign.
Another problem, the Clintons came up with a 1,300-page bill and asked Congress to pass it. Burke says the health reform effort would have fared better
had the president simply created a framework, given us a set of expectations and goals, and then allowed the Congress to essentially work through all the issues it had to work through in order to put something together that could pass legislatively.
Then, she says, there was the complexity of the bill. Chris Jennings sees that as a problem, too. Jennings was the White House senior health policy advisor throughout the Clinton years. He says the Clinton team learned that people fear change that they don't understand.
People aren't happy with their current health care system, but they aren't willing to trade up or down for anything until they know exactly what it is.
From what Jennings can see, Obama's campaign promises were the right ones, that people could keep what they have, it would be more secure and less expensive, and there'd be more choice. Obama didn't get bogged down in detail, says Jennings, and so far he's not pushing a lot of confusing mandates.
You don't hear about price controls or premium caps, or you don't talk about new government agencies.
Both Burke and Jennings are optimistic that this time around, something will happen. Burke says that's in no small part because health insurance costs more, and more people are uninsured than in 1993.
People are increasingly frightened, and their economic situation has grown worse. But as a result, they are losing their coverage. They are getting sicker. They are more costly to care for. So it's hard to imagine from a policy standpoint not addressing this issue.
Both Burke and Jennings are encouraged by the president-elect's pick of Tom Daschle to lead the Department of Health and Human Services and the health reform effort. Daschle, they say, knows how to get legislation through after his stint as Senate Majority Leader, and he knows health care because it's been one of his issues since his time as a Democratic senator. Daschle and Obama will have to pacify some powerful interests, insurers, doctors, hospitals, patient groups, and they're facing a skeptical public worried about losing what they have. Burke says the public has to prepare itself.
I think they have to anticipate that things will change.
Among the changes Obama has been calling for, employers would have to offer insurance or pay some kind of fine. Insurers would have to cover pre-existing conditions. The government would offer a health plan anyone could join. That's a lot simpler than the 1993 plan, but it's destined to get a lot more complicated as the details get worked out. The challenge will be to keep the public involved and on board until there's legislation ready to sign. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
Most of us assume the government is keeping track of environmental issues such as pollution in water. In reality, most pollution problems are first detected by citizens. Reporter Lester Graham says in some parts of the nation, volunteers step in to make sure their local streams and lakes are clean.
Rochelle Breitenbuck and Mary Badges are trudging through the snow, winding their way through a thicket to find a small creek. It's 14 degrees above zero, and they plan to go wading. They're lugging in a fine mesh net, some hip boots, and an orange 5-gallon bucket of trays and specimen jars. Breitenbuck says they're headed for a pristine creek that eventually becomes a river, the Huron River in southeast Michigan.
One thing about this spot is it's at that really close to the headwaters of the Huron River, so it's a really good indicator of what they're going to find downstream, too.
They're just one team of many that take samples up and down the river. They're looking for a certain kind of bug, stonefly larva. Stoneflies are good fish food, and they are very susceptible to pollution. They're considered an indicator species. If stoneflies are there and healthy, it's a good indication the stream is healthy.
Their food source is on the decomposing leaves, so that's where you find them. And then we'll kind of sort through the leaf packs and then look for stoneflies.
Breitenbach cautiously makes her way down the bank, across the ice, and into the water. She's taking her first sample in this open water. Badges steps out onto the ice, holding a plastic tray so Breitenbach can empty the net's contents into the tray. But the ice can't take the weight.
You okay?
Luckily, Badges didn't fall into the water. In these temperatures, that would have been bad. They scramble on up the snowy bank and start sorting through the debris in the trays to find stonefly larvae. Stoneflies have two tails. Mayflies have three tails, so they're squinting to see what they've got.
Oh, look, that's a mayfly.
Yeah, see all the tails?
Yeah.
No, look at the size of that one.
Look at that. That's two. That's got two. See?
Yep.
That's
gigantic. That's why we love this site.
Once they find one, they drop the bug into a jar of alcohol. After the thrill of finding the stoneflies, they hate to kill them, but they have to preserve the samples for biologists.
The whole jar goes back, and then Joe goes through and identifies everything.
Joe is Joe Lattimore. She's the Huron River Watershed Council's ecologist. She says without the volunteers' efforts all along the river, they'd never be able to monitor this river system as well. Lattimore says the end result of volunteer surveys like this one is a steady monitoring program that fills in the blanks left by government agencies that can't do the work.
The agencies that do have the responsibility for checking the quality of our water bodies really have very limited budgets, very limited staff. For example, in Michigan, the professional biologist from the DEQ can only get to a particular watershed every 5 years. And to really be able to stay on top of the conditions in a stream, you need to monitor more often than that.
Volunteer watershed organizations all across the nation assist government agencies in monitoring streams and lakes. But in many parts of the nation, there are no volunteer agencies. The water quality is rarely checked, and the only time anyone realizes there's a problem is when there's a huge fish kill or another pollution problem that gets the attention of people who live nearby or people who fish the streams. And nearly everyone agrees that's not a very good way to keep water clean. For the Environment Report, this is Lester Graham.
Lots of supermarkets encourage shoppers to carry reusable bags for their groceries by selling inexpensive canvas sacks. The idea is to reduce the use of plastic bags. Some states are making sure, though, that those plastic bags still used are recycled, Julie Grant reports.
New York has just joined California as only the second state to mandate stores collect and recycle plastic bags. Americans use over 80 billion plastic bags a year. They're usually made with oil. New York leaders are also concerned that the plastic litters streets and parks, waterways, and landfills. People usually throw bags out after just one use, but the plastic can take 1,000 years to decompose. Under the new state law, large stores and retail or grocery store chains will have to provide bins for collection of used carry-out bags. The stores will have to recycle the return bags and keep records for 3 years. Plastic bag makers are actually glad states are starting to mandate recycling. They say it will reduce the glut of bags and provide plastic for things such as weather-resistant lumber products. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gunn Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:51. The end of the College Bowl season means that some fans can finally stop watching 3 games at once on 3 separate televisions. They can finally get up off the couch, unless, of course, they're trying for TV greatness. NPR's Tom Bullock has the story.
The quest for the ultimate couch potato. The search for the one with the guts and grit to best all others in comfortably doing not much at all. Finally, a contest you could be advised to try at home. That is, until someone at ESPN turned it into a sport. Applications flooded in. The hand-picked finalists arrived on New Year's Day to the ESPN Zone sports bars in New York, Chicago, and here in Baltimore. This year's competition came complete with a referee and a rule book.
The official rules are that you must sit in your seat and you must be watching sports on TV the whole time. You can't fall asleep and you can't get out of your seat. Those are deal breakers. You're out if you do either of those things.
That's Lee Friedman. She's officiating the ultimate couch potato contest.
We say that you have to be sitting. Fortunately, I haven't had to really define sitting.
And they take their sitting here very seriously. After all, this is to crown the new king of the couch. Each contestant must remain in their faux leather recliner, complete with cup holder and airline-style tray table. Sound easy? Think about your last long plane flight.
2, 1, you can stand up and stretch. You have five.
Each hour on the hour, the finalists had 5 minutes to get up and stretch to make sure nothing went permanently numb. They got all the food and drink they wanted free of charge, but they could only use the restroom once every 8 hours. No exceptions. And this is what clearly separates the competitive couch potatoes from the amateurs. Well, that and a consumption strategy. Here's 23-year-old finalist Alex Pizik.
I've been sticking to the carrot cake, you know, when I need a quick burst of salt and sugar and green beans and salads.
Eat just enough to keep going, not enough to have to go. 26-year-old Jessica Mosley even trained for that.
I did. I actually practiced not going to the bathroom for 8 hours. like weird as that sounds, I practiced that to make sure it was feasible.
For some, it wasn't. One finalist here didn't make it past the first night, felled by a salmon dinner that didn't sit quite right. For those who survived, the nights were the real challenge. Remember, no sleeping allowed. And contestants were forced to watch the sports equivalent of infomercials. Finalist Craig McGarry.
We watched a rugby match, we watched a little cage fighting, and we watched, I think, wrestling from 1990 on ESPN Classic.
So, which city can claim to be home to the latest legend of lounging? Chicago declared its winner after 39 hours. New York, they threw in the towel just 18 hours in, so much for the city that never sleeps.
I wish I lived in New York to enter that contest.
But Alex Pizik and the Baltimore finalists kept sitting and watching and waiting to see who would be the new A-Rod of recliners, the Secretariat of the sofa. And just who did win?
I did. The girl kicked their butts.
That's right. After 70 hours and 22 seconds, Jessica Mosley outsat them all, shattering the current Guinness Book Couch Potato World Record. Who knew? Tom Bullock, NPR News.
It's 5 minutes before 3 o'clock. Let's take a look at Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana for the remainder of this afternoon. North and central, mostly cloudy and blustery with a few flurries and snow showers. In the south this afternoon, cloudy with scattered showers of snow, possibly mixed with rain at times. Highs ranging from 20 in northwestern Illinois to near 45 in the far south. Tonight in northern Illinois, partly cloudy. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with widely scattered flurries. Lows ranging from 10 in northwestern Illinois to 25 in the south. Tomorrow in northern and eastern Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy with some lake effect snow showers. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Highs tomorrow, Thursday, ranging from near 20 in northern Illinois to 40 in far southern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly cloudy and breezy with a few flurries. The high 30, the wind from the west at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries or a brief snow shower, mainly this evening. The low tonight, 17, the wind from the west to northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny, the high around 30, the wind from the northwest to west at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, the low 17. The outlook for Friday, intervals of clouds and sunshine, not as cold Friday, the high 42. And the outlook for Saturday, partly sunny, the high around 30.
Earth and sky.
In September 2008, scientists launched a team of undersea robot gliders to learn about changes in ocean currents.
We've been trying out gliders as part of a monitoring program in the North Atlantic, and that's aiming to monitor the overturning circulation of the Atlantic.
You're listening to oceanographer David Smead of the National Oceanography Center in England. The gliders are monitoring a system of currents known as the Atlantic Heat Conveyor, which influences European climate.
So really that's the part of the ocean circulation that transports heat polewards from the equatorial regions. So in particular, think of the Gulf Stream bringing warm water, which has an important influence on the climate of continents at high latitudes.
Scientists have relied on moored instruments, which provide data only about once a year. But the torpedo-like gliders can roam and report on the sea for up to 100 days and deliver more speedy information on the ocean currents.
They come up to the surface each day and communicate with us via satellite.
Climate change models have predicted that these ocean currents are slowing. The gliders will help scientists find out if that's true. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 2 minutes before 3 o'clock. You're tuned to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM.